Welcome to the Shenanigans Podcast. This is a production of the Marire Media Group, but not necessarily affiliated with Native Expat Radio, because that's for entertainment and Palawan music, and this is my personal, somewhat ranty podcast. Don't get me wrong, I'm still here to disseminate information and educate. It's just that there's a lot more of me in this podcast, and it probably contains swearing. Sorry, not sorry. All right, this is the new news portion of the podcast because I'm trying to figure out a format that works, so yeah. If you're new to the podcast, welcome. If you've already been here, welcome. I'm making an effort to get these episodes out more consistently because I'm on Spotify and I'm taking that as a sign that I need to get my shit together and podcast. Also, because it's Spotify, I felt compelled to have new cover art for the podcast. So that's Cartoon Me that I drew. Not particularly well, but I have problems with visual spatial processing, so cut me some slack. Also, just apologies for the background noise. I live on the other side of the freeway from downtown Honolulu, and that means there is automotive noise and sirens and occasionally screaming or whatever else in the background. So again, apologies for that. So getting to the actual news portion, and wait, quick shameless self-promoting note here. I try to post relevant news items on marire.com. Sometimes I'm timely, and sometimes I'm less so. But this news clip is actually from the Rachel Maddow Show, and it's worth paying attention to, so please keep listening.
Friedrich von Steuben was born in 1730 in the Kingdom of Prussia, an area that is now modern-day Germany. At 17, he joined the Prussian army and fought in the Seven Years' War. At that time, the Prussian army was one of the most sophisticated and powerful armies in the world. Von Steuben had a distinguished military career, eventually becoming a top aide to Frederick the Great. He's also believed to have been an openly gay man, which is no small thing in the 1700s in Prussia, because back then, being gay was actually a crime. In 1763, Friedrich von Steuben was abruptly dismissed from the Prussian army. It was rumored at the time that he was let go because he was gay. And so, with no job and nowhere to go, Friedrich von Steuben went to America. He arrived in the States in the throes of the Revolutionary War in 1777. The Continental Army was losing. They had just suffered through a bitter winter at Valley Forge. The troops were demoralized. They were living in filth. They were untrained. George Washington needed someone to whip his men into shape to teach them how to properly fight a war. And it was right around that time that George Washington met Friedrich von Steuben. He was impressed with his military experience and with his strong personality. And so Washington hired von Steuben. Von Steuben was not given a military title. He was not even an American. But he took the job anyway to help secure the emerging new country's independence. He trained Washington's army at Valley Forge. He taught them how to march, how to stay in line, how to reload their muskets. He taught them how to pitch tents and build latrines and run kitchens. And he did it all in broken English. When the troops failed to follow orders, he would curse at them in German and French. One of the only English phrases he knew was, "Squad, halt!" But in less than 2 months, this gay man from Prussia turned a ragtag group of guys with guns into a professional army. He helped create an identity, an order, a learned skill among this group of soldier trainees to teach them how to fight and win the war. Friedrich von Steuben served in the Continental Army until the end of the American Revolutionary War. He wrote a book to memorialize all the lessons that he taught the American troops. They called it the Blue Book, because all von Steuben had to write on was blue paper, which has since faded a bit. The U.S. Army still uses portions of the Blue Book to teach new recruits to this very day. Friedrich von Steuben from Prussia is credited with creating America's professional army, which is now the most powerful fighting force in the world. And again, this little-known hero of the American Revolution who volunteered to help this country win its independence, to help turn the tide of the war in America's favor, was not actually American. During the war, he wrote this letter to George Washington explaining why he volunteered to fight for a country that was not his own. He told Washington, quote, "The object of my greatest ambition is to render your country all the services in my power and to deserve the title of a citizen of America by fighting for the cause of your liberty." And in 1784, von Steuben got his wish. As a thank you for his service, as a reward for his sacrifices that he'd made to America, the Pennsylvania legislature passed a law that made him a U.S. citizen. Friedrich von Steuben lived out the rest of his days in the United States. The immigrant soldier from Prussia who created the professional American army died at home in New York as an American citizen. Ever since the Revolutionary War, immigrants in this country have represented a significant, vital part of our armed forces. They fought in every single war this country has ever engaged in. It's been codified in our history, dating back to Friedrich von Steuben and his Blue Book. Deciding to risk your life for a country is a brave and incredible sacrifice, but risking your life for someone else's country, that's something else. Like other presidents before him, George W. Bush recognized that incredible sacrifice. In December 2008, at the very tail end of his presidency, he started something called MAVNI. It stands for Military Accessions Vital to the National Interest, MAVNI. It was a program that allowed immigrants living in the United States to get a fast track to citizenship if they joined the armed forces, an attempt to recognize the extraordinary contribution and sacrifice they had made by enlisting. When the program first launched, it was built for 1,000 people. Right off the bat, more than 14,000 immigrants living in this country called up Army recruiters asking how they could be a part of the program, asking how they could serve the country and become U.S. citizens. The immigrants who enlisted through the program scored significantly higher on their entrance exams. On average, they were more highly educated. They filled serious deficits in the Army. Doctors and dentists and speakers of languages in far-flung corners of the world where American forces were operating. During President Obama's tenure, the program recruited psychologists to help with the severe emotional distress experienced by soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq. The policy really has been bipartisan. In 2014, President Obama expanded the program to allow DACA recipients to participate. One immigrant who volunteered to serve was a dentist from Philadelphia named Amin Dhillon. He was born in India and moved to the United States in 2006. He was an Ivy League graduate with a postdoctoral degree in two dental specialties. He told the New York Times he wanted to join the U.S. Army because of the opportunity to treat a wide range of patients. He said that he was not afraid of the risks of service. Quote, "This country does not differentiate between color or accent. Here, if you are good, people will put you to the front." And that was the whole idea. Take these brave, selfless immigrants who came to this country and enlisted in the Army and reward their sacrifice with citizenship, putting them to the front. Well, last year, the Trump administration suspended the MAVNI program. They stopped promising citizenship to immigrants who agreed to risk their lives for this country. And then late last night, this was the headline at the Associated Press: U.S. Army quietly discharging immigrant recruits. Quote, "Some immigrant U.S. Army reservists and recruits who enlisted in the military with a promised path to citizenship are being abruptly discharged," the Associated Press has learned. Now, we do not know how many people enlisted through this program have been booted from the Army, but immigration attorneys say they know of more than 40 who have been discharged and whose status has become questionable, jeopardizing their futures. One of those 40 people is Lucas Calixto, a Brazilian immigrant who filed a lawsuit against the Army last week. He says it was his dream to serve in the U.S. Army, to give back to his adopted country, a dream that had come true until they kicked him out. So what does this mean and where does it go from here? Joining us now is Margaret Stock, an Alaska-based immigration attorney and a retired U.S. Army Reserve Lieutenant Colonel who helped create the immigrant recruitment program. Colonel Stock, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me to be on the show. I'm really pleased to be here.
Thank you. And so do we know what is being told to these recruits who joined under the MAVNI program and are now being essentially de-enlisted?
Well, they're getting text messages, emails, phone calls, and they're being told that somehow they failed a background check, but no one will tell them why they failed or what the details of the failure are.
And is there something in the background check, maybe a form they filled out, that indicates that maybe there was something dishonest on the forms they filled out, that maybe there's something they did proactively to cause this, or is this just part of winding down this MAVNI program, to your knowledge?
Well, what's happened is the Department of Defense a couple of years ago decided they wanted to do extreme vetting on all these recruits, and they ordered up a whole set of new background checks but had no capability to do them. So this resulted in delays of 2 and even 3 years they're facing now before they can fully participate in the military and their military careers, because they're basically stuck waiting while they undergo these background checks. And DOD last year had revealed a plot to simply cancel all your contracts because it didn't want to spend the money doing the background checks on them. There was a public uproar about that, and DOD canceled those plans and went forward with the background checks, but it became clear that it was going to take many, many, many years before DOD would be able to complete them. And so in the last few weeks, we've suddenly seen a surge in mysterious discharges where they're suddenly being told they're being kicked out of the military and nobody will tell them why. They're not given a reason. They're not given any documents to prove that they did anything wrong. They're simply being told that they failed their background check somehow. One recruit coincidentally got a hold of some of the paperwork that purportedly supported the argument that he had failed his background check. And the paperwork indicated that he hadn't really failed it. In fact, the only reason they were kicking him out was because he had, quote, foreign ties. Now, these are immigrants, so they all have foreign ties. And the documents cited that he got coincidentally said that he had a parent who lived in his home country who owned property, and that when the parent passed away, he was going to inherit the property. And he had told an investigator that he planned to sell the property and use the money to invest in property in the United States. That was cited as some suspicious derogatory information. And then the second thing they said that he had done was he had a girlfriend, a fiance in his home country, somebody he'd known since he was a child, and he planned to sponsor her to come to the United States to marry him after he became an American citizen.
Wow. You said I think an important word there as you were describing what's going on, and it's contract. And presumably, if the United States is making a contract with, and you can maybe give me an estimate of how many people, how many thousands of people that might have such contracts in place, is there anything in that contract that says that it is revocable at any time for any reason?
Well, it's a military enlistment contract, so the Army believes it's binding on him, but of course, the military services often decide that somebody's not qualified to enlist in the military. Normally, though, and under Army regulations, if a person supposedly failed a background check, they tell the person. They bring them in, they say, it appears that you failed a background check because you did the following things. What do you have to say for yourself? This is a fundamental principle called due process. But in these cases, none of these people are being told why they failed. And in fact, their units, their commanders don't know why they failed. Some of the people who supposedly failed these background checks recently received a promotion, got an award. There's nothing in their background or history to indicate that they did anything wrong, but mysteriously and suddenly they're receiving these discharge orders and being told that they failed a background check.
Wow, a pretty disturbing story, particularly so close to the 4th of July. Margaret Stock, Alaska-based immigration attorney and retired U.S. Army Reserve Lieutenant Colonel, thank you very much for being here tonight and giving us information on this.
Okay, so that was Joy Reid. She's guest hosting The Rachel Maddow Show. And I know that was kind of a long segment, and I didn't include it to scare anyone. However, it is safe to say that at the very least, the United States is kind of out of sorts right now. And so while I personally haven't heard of any instances where this has happened to either Palauans, Micronesians, American Samoans, or anyone else who is from a country associated or under the United States that shouldn't have to deal with this nonsense, it is something that you need to know about and you need to be aware of, even if it doesn't directly affect you. Because as a human being living in the world, it is important to know what is going on around you. However, if any of the listeners do hear something about this, they do know of anyone that this has affected directly, please do let me know. The whole purpose of having the news segment in the podcast is to disseminate information and make sure people are aware of stuff that, at least at that time, I felt was relevant and needed to be brought up. I wanted to change things up a bit and maybe lighten the tone of this episode, but I realize now that the story I'm about to tell actually gets worse before it gets better. It's actually a really cool story, and you can read the whole version of it, which includes my whole coming out saga, on Medium, where I'm, of course, Meride, or at meride.com. It's titled Before Pride Month Ends. You can also read the entire tweet thread that it was based on Twitter, where I'm Sha_Meride, and I believe it's currently pinned to my account. So I missed a brilliant opportunity to tell this whole story during June, which was Pride Month, which is unfortunate, but I'm gonna go ahead and tell at least the mini part of this story now because it relates to future episodes I'll be doing, which is they're gonna be under, I guess, the category of Native Expat Revisited, where I talk about the few years I lived in Palau as a Palauan American who had never been to Palau before. So again, you can check this out on Twitter, you can check it out on Medium, you can check it out at meride.com. This particular story though is from the section titled An Axe-Wielding Lunatic Comes For Me. So bear with me. Now I moved to Palau December 2011, and I can tell you right away, like before I landed, it was already, things were rough. My father's older brother, Danny, had already decided he didn't want me living with him, even though he's actually the reason I was moving to Palau. He invited me to stay with him, and we made all these plans, and I actually found all this out while I was at the airport in Guam, waiting on my flight to Palau. So, as I'm sure you can imagine, I was utterly devastated. I did make it to Palau, and I survived 3 weeks of living in his home despite being gaslighted daily and pretty much driven to the point of suicidal ideation. This is where I stop, and I have to thank my mom's family in Ngargasual, my grandmother and my mother's two brothers, my cousins, everyone there, for basically rescuing me from what was the most toxic living situation I have ever been in, ever. So a lot of crazy, chaotic things happened while I lived in Palau, and again, I'll write about them eventually. But again, this is kind of a trigger warning story. It's related to homophobia, it's related to threats of violence, so I want that out there before anyone listens further in case they need to hear that. So as I was getting into my third year of living in Palau, I had lost my grandfather, and I was actually spending a lot more time at the family house in Malgeok. That house at this point was inhabited by my dad's younger brother, Niganor, Nick, as we call him. And after my grandfather had passed away, we had talked a lot about me moving there, but I had serious reservations about living at the house. Again, my Uncle Danny and basically his whole household and I were not on speaking terms, I guess, unless we saw each other in public, and it was really just kind of him expressing whatever distaste at me just through his eyes. It was like a glare, stare and glare thing from him. Despite the house being my Uncle Nick's house, which was kind of, everyone knew this prior to my grandfather passing, was that he was the one who took care of the house, he was the one who lived in the house, therefore it was his home. I was scared that Danny would find a way to ban me from it. I mean, he had already banned me from my grandfather's funeral, which I don't know how, but I managed to show up at, and I went to for Omalwosu. And I mean, honestly, this man has, I don't know if he's still, but I mean, at the time he had been going around Palau gossiping about me to our own family, like I wasn't somehow his brother's child who he invited to live there. But anyway, so my girlfriend at the time and I had agreed to move to Junto, and we were going to move in with my Uncle Nick. And it was great, honestly. We got into this schedule-based routine. We were kind of embodying the concept of Klaingasew. I mean, it was the first few weeks that we'd been there, it was peaceful. It was great. We helped each other. It was perfect. We had like our homeostasis thing going. And then an axe-wielding lunatic showed up at the house. So, and no lie, like, so my Uncle Danny, who lives in Lermith, showed up in Malgeok with an axe. And I don't really know what led up to it. I vaguely recall that him and my Uncle Nick had been on the phone, and I think he was complaining about me living at the house. But I don't know if it was that my Uncle Nick had hung up on him on the phone or what it was that just triggered him. But he drove his ass from Lermith in Koror all the way to Marubusang in Malgeok, where we stayed. And literally ran around the house with an axe, screaming like "Modiging ilang ilab ilaradil," which, I mean, if you don't speak Palawan, like, kick her out. She's married to a woman. And you know, for like someone who kept insisting that he was very ashamed of the life I lived, he had like no problem announcing it and screaming it out to the world. And so, this went on long enough that everyone in Marubusang who was there basically could like come outside and look and. It was basically like, oh my God, what the hell is happening? And quick note, for the record, I wasn't married. Palau doesn't allow same-sex marriage, and homosexuality was decriminalized after I left in 2014. However, I did file a police report on the incident. And so, I mean, anyone who wants to say, like, this didn't happen or whatever, like, there is a police report. I filed it. And at that time, I regretted filing it because they went and served him that complaint at his workplace, Rangarulmut, at the Capitol, where he worked as a legal researcher for the Senate. So I'm assuming that embarrassed him. And then a few nights later, Danny and his wife, Dorin, showed up at the house and evicted me and my then-girlfriend. This was later on in the evening. It was a non-payday week. I didn't have the gas or the money to get to Koror. So we packed, well, she packed basically all of our belongings. And we drove to Imarang in Ngiwal, where we spent the night just kind of sitting there trying to figure out what to do while I sobbed hysterically. So while we were in Imarang, Taora Imarang, I managed to call my parents. And I vaguely remember being kind of hysterical. I was sobbing. I told them what had happened. I wanted to go home. They stayed on the phone with me for what I can only imagine must have been like a heartbreak eternity. Like, that's the only way I could ever think of it. And all they could keep doing was telling me to be strong and to fight back. See, this is always better in writing, because in writing, I don't like tear up from telling the story. So, like, I'm on the phone, I'm sobbing, I'm probably hyperventilating, and my dad just straight up says, this is not the time to leave. And I'm, like, hysterical, and I'm like, no, this is the time to leave, I've been kicked out, I don't have anywhere to go, the only place we could go was Ngiwal, I don't have gas to get to Koror, I live in Palau, I'm broke, fuck, help. And my dad says, this is the time to seek revenge. And like, seeking revenge is not really where my head was at that point, but then, you know, I had to listen to my dad. So he says, it's the time to seek revenge by being true to myself and succeeding professionally, because my uncle is a damn curmudgeon who only associates success with money, property, and titles. And because my dad raised me, because my dad helped form my definition of success, he knows that is not what I believe. For us, success has nothing to do with accumulating material wealth. It's everything to do with reaching out to my community and helping as many people as possible. And fuck, if you go broke doing it, you go broke doing it. But my parents supported me emotionally and mentally from the U.S., and they pushed me to seek that success despite whatever hate was coming out from within our own family. And my dad's whole, like, everything around that was that the greatest success you will find is in being yourself and just succeeding in the sense that you're happy, not what makes them think you're successful, not what makes people appreciate you more, but succeeding in the things that you're passionate about, that you care about. So that's my story portion of the podcast. And I wanted to tell this story. This goes out to all the cutie pies, the queer, trans, Pacific Islanders listening. But it also goes out to anyone who's ever had to deal with the collision of self and culture and had to try to piece themselves back together, like, thereafter. That was a really rough time for me, living in Palau and dealing with my dad's family. And a lot of times I kind of marvel at how I survived it, despite the fact that there were so many traumatic things that happened. But the thing is, it did happen, and I'm grateful it happened, and I'm grateful that it formed me into the person that I am so that I can look back and also look forward with more empathy, I guess, and compassion, and try to understand things in different ways. How's that for a story? This is another segment that I intend to make a regular part of the show, and it's actually a nice segue from the last segment. This is the mental health check-in. And as someone who's been grappling with the ups and downs, mainly downs, of bipolar disorder and mostly mild OCD since puberty, and also someone who's been struggling with social anxiety and agoraphobia since my mid-20s, mental health wellness and self-awareness are pretty big themes in my everyday life. So I will be using this segment to talk briefly about that, but it's also open to contributors and guests who are willing to discuss mental health issues. And I totally encourage anyone interested to contact me through any of the social media platforms. I'm on most of them, and my name is always some variation of Marire, Sha Marire. So our topic today is actually one of my favorites, self-care. Okay, so a quick rundown, what is self-care? Self-care is basically any activity we do deliberately in order to take care of our mental, emotional, and physical health. You would think this is a really simple concept, right? But it's actually something we overlook pretty much all the time. Good self-care, though, is basically key to improving your mood, reducing anxiety, and it's also a good way to have a good relationship with yourself and other people. On the flip side of that, it's not something that you would force yourself to do, something that you don't enjoy. The idea of self-care is that it should refuel you rather than taking from you, and it's also not a selfish act. It's not just about considering your own needs, but about knowing what you need to do in order to take care of yourself and subsequently being able to take care of others. So it's that whole, if I don't know how to take care of myself, I won't be in the right mindset to take care of my loved ones. So that said, here's a cool little clip from BuzzFeed Blue where people talk about their favorite forms of self-care.
I need self-care because I can get overwhelmed pretty easily.
I developed a self-care routine because I have depression. Earlier this year, my grandfather passed away somewhat quickly and tragically. I've struggled with anxiety my whole life.
I deal with clinical depression. When I read about a bunch of awful crap that happens, like, it just gets me in a really, really bad mood.
If I don't just set aside time for, hey, I gotta take care of myself, I just destroy myself as a human being.
My favorite type of self-care is yoga. When you're mentally stressed, it also affects your body physically. So it's really important to release that tension because it will also release your mental tension.
My form of self-care is my journal. My thoughts and feelings will drive me insane if I don't get them out in some way, so I write them down.
Going to the gym helps me stay sane. It allows me to turn off my thoughts for an hour. I find if I've had a shitty day at work or just a shitty day in general, and I go to the gym, I often feel better afterwards.
Meditation is one of my forms of self-care. It's just so nice to be able to take a minute to just chill. To be someone with anxiety and say that you can get back in control and within 10 minutes is so wonderful.
My form of self-care is playing video games. When you play a video game, you're focusing on one thing, and it's just winning and beating the level. And it sounds dumb, but having those small accomplishments, it just makes you feel a little bit better about yourself.
One of my biggest forms of self-care is art and drawing and illustrating and really anything in the arts. Just to be able to like put down on pen and paper or paint untainted by anyone else's opinions. It's really interesting because I typically create more when I'm sad or frustrated or angry.
One of my self-care routines is reading, especially poems, especially something that can just get me out of my world. If I'm reading something that's about somewhere far away, it just removes me from my immediate situation and lets me think about somebody or something else.
Finding the right self-care routine is not something that's instantaneous. It takes like a lot of trial and error.
It's good to find things that allow you to distract yourself.
Keeping my illness from taking over my life requires a daily effort.
Just take that time to do something for yourself.
Also, for anyone who's dealing with or knows someone who may be dealing with self-harm, thoughts of self-harm, or suicidal ideation, please know that there is a nationwide hotline. It's available 24/7. Their number is 1-800-273-8255. In addition to friends and family, there are a handful of people who listen to Native Expat Radio or are otherwise acquainted with me through my work. And throughout the years, they've contacted me just time to time for mental health check-ins, or even just I'll listen while they vent. So that said, if you ever find yourself with too much on your mind and you need someone to like listen, I guess read if you're chatting, while you untangle your thoughts, again, I'm available on pretty much all the social media platforms. And yes, I understand it's a lot to tell someone to reach out, and I'm definitely not saying that you need to talk to me, but I'm here for you. Thank you again for tuning in to this episode of the Shenanigans podcast. To be honest, I'm not sure what the schedule is going to be like for the podcast quite yet, so please bear with me. Not like that. Once I get the show format finalized, though, this will be a shit ton easier to do. Also, if you have a show idea or you'd like to talk about something on the show, let me know. I am always down to use any of my platforms to help out the community. Don't forget, I am literally on pretty much every social media platform. So reach out if you need to, and until next time, please don't drink and drive, don't drink and text, don't drink and tweet, don't drink and do anything you might regret by morning, because come morning you'll regret it. Native expat listeners know this line. This has been the Shenanigans podcast, and I'm Shaw, and I'm off to do some nanigan-ing. Yeah.